So last Sunday morning, if you were here, Wally took us on this lovely journey through several of what I would think of as grounding stories. Grounding stories for me is a synonym idea for mythology, which I'm not going to unpack at the moment, but took us through a number of grounding stories from the deep traditions of his indigenous culture and history, as well as from his personal life experience. If you were not able to be here, I would strongly encourage you to take the time to listen to the podcast of that. Unless you have a long commute, it might be a tad longer than your commute, but the rhythm of it is so gorgeous. Anyway, just in the story, just never mind, go listen. Easiest way to find that, if that's not something you've done, is to just go to our website, thetablewinnipeg.com. There's a whole podcast archive there. Wally's will be right on the top of the page. There's also a bunch of other sort of helpful things there, if that's not a familiar place, including a calendar. It's where the weekly blurbs get posted. If you're not on our email list, let me know, we can put you on there, but they always show up there at the end of the week as well, and so on. Anyway, I was struck by many things that Wally shared, and as I've had more and more occasions to hear from my First Nations kinfolk, I've been blown away time after time by the beautiful and the generous spirit in which the stories and wisdom are so often offered. And it seems to me, as a person with settler heritage, that there are so many good reasons for the tone with which the indigenous voice would speak into our culture. There's so many good reasons for that tone to be one of just full-blown rage all the time. And that just has not been what I've encountered. I mean, of course, there's direct speech about what's been messed up, what's been lost. There's also some anger that feels like it's good and right to me. Because to experience the kind of injustice that First Nations people have known and continue to know, I think could either elicit one of two things. It could either produce dangerous repression, or it could generate some anger. But the grace that I feel like I often encounter in those situations keeps taking me by surprise, and it feels like it always goes, like, just kind of skips the complexity and goes straight to my heart. And then it works its way back into my head and the complexity's there again. But the doorway of my heart feels like it's opened by the grace of those communiques. And so I was really grateful for Wally's grace in our community as he expressed it last week. And I was also very conscious of Wally's connection to the earth as mother. And I was really drawn to the way that so many of the teachings that he shared brought us as a community back to what is beneath, on, and above the earth, the phrase that he used in particular, beneath, on, and above the earth. And that also turned us toward Creator, the source of all it is. And as Wally told his stories last week, I felt like there was a voice in my spirit. I felt like the drum of my own heart was sort of chanting, yes, yes, yes. Pay attention. And when I sat back and reflected a bit on what that voice was calling me to pay attention to, one of the themes that kept coming up was longing. I don't think it's a coincidence that I'm thinking about longing these days. We're sort of hovering, as Tim reminded us, just maybe tipping over the edge into, you know, serious winter, which by default in me triggers a longing for spring. And it's not because I dislike the seasons. Having spent brief periods of time in some places with less dramatic seasons, like almost instant boredom, you know, in terms of environment. I would miss the seasons a great deal if I didn't live where they were. And I enjoy them, including winter. But I also know that winter can be long and sort of hard to face into, both literally and otherwise. And I know that in winter's past, my experience of those things has been pretty benign compared to the struggles that lots of people face, whether that's with things at the most basic level of adequate warm clothing or shelter, or with emotional or mental health challenges, because lots of those things are exacerbated by this season. And of course, this time of the year includes, you know, the holidays, by whatever name we might call them, and that often doesn't seem to actually help. I was talking with a friend recently about the moral failings of religion. You know, casual conversation. Anyway, I feel fortunate to have friends for whom that can be not an unusual topic. But anyway, we were talking about the moral failings of religion and how they seem to elicit such a strong reaction from people in general. And I made the observation that I think that has a lot to do with the claims that religion makes for itself. So if you say that your religion has a handle on things like the way, the truth, and the life, and then you live in ways that are clearly not walking in the way of love, in ways that hide the truth, in ways that hand out eternal death sentences to those that don't believe like you do, you should probably expect some backlash, you know, because the claims that you've made and the thing that you're doing are so dissonant from one another. Now, add to that dilemma, this particular time of the year, when religious messages from a tradition that sometimes behaves that way are blasting over pretty much every speaker in the mall. Like, when else would you walk around in retail land and get soaked in Middle Ages Christian theology? That would be now. So that's kind of what's going on. And then you link that to these patterns of runaway consumption and this perennial blindness that we seem to exhibit about trying to purchase joy. Like, it's got to be willful blindness by now. Stir in, like, a healthy dose of, you know, overwrought and romanticized expectations about relational or familial happiness. And I mean, if that's not a stew that's going to cook up and produce unrequited longing, I don't know what is. Like, it's just sort of all there, right? Yeah, it's pretty much the perfect storm. When our hearts are filled with longing, however that comes to be, however that gets, you know, churned up, and nothing we seem to be doing is working, where do we go from there? Well, if I may, I would like to take a cue from what Wally shared last week and start with Mother Earth. When Wally told the story about how Creator gave all the peoples one path to walk and said, "Walk in it and you will be well as people," and then how that unraveled more and more until people, because people kept leaving the path, people groups kept leaving the path, and it unraveled more and more until people were finally called back to that path by a determined child. I kept thinking, I know I am pretty much the opposite of indigenous, and I know this is not my story, but man, does it ever sound familiar. And I don't want to conflate one mythology with another. I think that would do a great disservice to all the stories and peoples concerned, and I think it would also potentially rob us of our human experience of the beautiful diversity we have to share. However, I do not think it's categorically problematic to suggest that our human stories, our mythologies, our grounding narratives, that these things have some deep and abiding questions in common. Wally touched on that early in what he shared last week when he talked about the great questions that the indigenous elders want to help the young ones answer. Questions like, who am I? What kind of world am I living in? What's my purpose here? Where do I find hope? And although he didn't include it in that compact list of questions, he explored it deeply in other stories, this idea that all of these questions have a context. And the context is our life here on our home, the earth. Heard somebody make the distinction this past week between setting and context. Tim, you could do a way better job of this than I could, I'm sure. But in brief, as I remember it, setting doesn't change the way you experience something. So, for example, the way you have an embodied experience with something. So if you go in to get your portrait taken, and the photographer was like, would you like a black backdrop or would you like a white backdrop? The backdrop is your setting, all right? If you're standing there waiting to get your picture taken and you're like, I can't smile because my face is frozen because it's 10 degrees in this studio, that's your context, okay? It's what you're surrounded by. It's the experience you're having. Our context is this home. It's Earth. And I believe that one of the longings that we have in common in that context is our longing for home. Now, not just any home, but a home that we can have some reasonable hope will be there at the end of the day. I don't know if you've ever had occasion, it will probably be a relatively short list in this room, of people who've had the occasion to be out and about and really seriously doubt whether their home would be there when they came back at the end of the day. Day after day after day. But a lot of the world lives like that. That sense of home is not just like for basic shelter. It's about its predictability to some degree as well, right? We long for a home that is big enough, that is welcoming enough, that is stable enough to embrace us, to surround us, not just when things are going great, but when things feel like they're not going great, when we feel like things are flying apart. I can come home. And it might not make the things that are flying apart all go away, but it's a reprieve, right? And that longing, I think, is so strong and so powerful that when we feel like the world around us, and in our epoch, perhaps even when we feel like the earth beneath us, with us and above us, isn't that kind of home, we will invent one somewhere else to reassure ourselves. The drive is very powerful. That longing is a big deal for us as human beings. And I'm not going to explore this today because I want to spend some time sort of on the positive side of the problem. By the time I'm done, you'll wonder if I managed to stay on the positive side, I suspect. But let's see how it goes. But within my religion, in terms of tradition of origin for me, the power of that longing combined with, I don't know, lots of ways we could approach this, let's say enlightenment dualism and human suffering, has resulted in what I recently heard someone call some not very helpful theologies about our home, the earth. Theologies that suggest that our true home is actually somewhere else and this whole place is destined to kind of go up in cataclysmic smoke, you know, that paradise is an actual address, but for sure it's not here, and so on. And that has produced, among other things, a rash of pretty bizarre end times ideas. One of which sometimes gets pinned to this particular text from Luke's gospel, which says, "Be on guard so that your hearts are not weighed down with dissipation." Anyway, what a great word. When was the last time you dissipated? Are we going to talk about this in public? My God. Anyway. Nobody knows what dissipation means. You got to look it up every time. "Be on guard so that your hearts are not weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life, and that day catch you unexpectedly." Was that not a great voice at the end? So right now, some of us, I know this, I can see it on your faces. Right now, some of us are picturing bad Christian movie moments. Right, like right now, some of us are seeing airplanes without pilots and cars without drivers and people waking up in a bed that had two people in it, but now it only has one because they've been what? Left behind. Anyway, for a lot of us, when we think about that day in Luke's text, this day which we should not be caught unawares in, that's kind of what goes with it, right? But that text is not about some kind of sudden departure of the select few to some other place or even to some other state of being. That's not what the context is for the people that Luke is writing to. If we treat this text that way, we're getting context confused with background. We're sort of putting a thing behind it and saying this is what it stands in front of as opposed to this is what surrounds it. It's not what surrounds that story. In its context, to the people that Luke was writing to, it's about being alert. It's actually about paying attention. And it's about being alert even when your circumstances are truly threatening. Even when there are powerful people that might show up at any moment to take you away. Even when they might come completely blindside you, take your partner, take your children, take your home, take your land, take your way of life. The people that Luke is writing to live with imminent real threats of that nature. And so when Luke says, be on guard, and when Luke talks about the worries of this life and the day catching you unexpectedly, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about a life in which we are being called to pay attention to the mysterious ways in which the divine comes to us, even when, perhaps especially when, everything's not going great. Those ways I'm inclined to call mysterious, partly because I like what the word is about. Surprise, I like the word. The word mystery comes from a Greek root that means closed lips. Isn't that interesting? So it's a word that points to the importance of standing in the presence of what is greater than us, what confounds us, and silently attending to it. It's about guarding our hearts, not by barricading them with fear, but by opening to the presence of the love and goodness for which we may choose to use God language. And one of the ways that we do that as humans is stories. They help us attend to that mystery. Stories about love both giving birth to and also deeply occupying all aspects of this exact world we're in, this earth that is our home, this place that is, as the poet and environmentalist Wendell Berry writes, and as the wisdom of our indigenous kin pointed out from before any history was getting written down, this earth that has, this is Wendell Berry's actual phrase, he says it this way, everything we need is right here. Next week, I want to explore some really practical ways that we can engage in caring for our home, the earth, by also caring for ourselves. We'll talk about and we'll participate in a limited way in some practices that can, among other things, help us to pay attention to the possible presence of the divine embedded in our human experiences in ways that bring us to the best kind of stunned silence that can bring us to awe and wonder as they were meant to be drawn from us. But for this morning's talky bit, what I want to do is try to illustrate that idea from a well-known Christmas song. More accurately, within the tradition, from a well-known Advent song. Meaningful distinction? Hard to know in a given community. Now, if you grew up deeply Protestant, Advent still might be like, isn't that what those other people, the high church, you know, like, you know, the Catholics, the people we need to evangelize, isn't that what they do? Anyway, Advent, of course, is the season of anticipation that arrives at Christmas. And I always think of it sort of like Lent with lights, right? It's a season of waiting for something and longing for something. Anyway, this is an Advent song. And it's one that holds a space that is very different from the prevailing norms that our culture tends to broadcast at this time of the year. It's one of those, there's something about that songs, at least for me. It's one of those songs that kind of hits a deep spot in me. And I don't know if you have songs like this, songs that when they come on, your hair kind of prickles or you tear up or you have some kind of a surge of emotion, like something just kind of goes off in your heart that the circumstances don't quite account for. Like, I don't know. Or maybe even sometimes you have that experience even when you really don't think you should. This is one of those for me. You have this experience like whatever is happening that stirs those feelings is in itself problematic. Like there's the thing that's stirring your emotion or touching your heart runs against the grain of your best shot at a better ideology, and you kind of know it, but you're still having the experience. So this past week, earlier this week, I got to go see Miss Bennett Christmas at Pemberley at MTC with Taya. So, I don't know. So for those of you unfamiliar, perhaps, this is a freshly imagined sequel to Pride and Prejudice. So just put yourself in that Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen kind of space, and you got the vibe. And like everything that MTC presents, it was lushly staged, it was beautifully produced, it was creatively scored, and some particular nuances about that I was enjoying. All these things that sort of make for grand, traditional theater. And it's a love story, of course. It's got the same family of characters as Pride and Prejudice. And we were at a matinee, so we were seeing this in a room full of school kids. all of whom were just like dying in anticipation of the kiss at the end, to such a degree that when it finally happened, and oh man, they drug it out. I don't mean the kiss, I mean waiting for the kiss. The room like burst into spontaneous applause. This is really kind of sweet. But that whole story happens in Regency England. In Regency England, women are just shy of enslaved property. Most of the country is owned by a few rich white men who hold all the land and all the power. There are wars going on, but they're far away. And all the characters in the story seem to have to do is keep the social rules, decorate for Christmas, and talk about one another. And it's a world that is so out of balance as to be not just off-putting, but deeply offensive. But I'm sitting there with Taya, fogging up my glasses from crying at the story of this neglected middle daughter finding true love with a clumsy, bookish, newly minted young lord who shows up to take inheritance of his estate next door. By the way, potentially turning out the girl who grew up there her entire life. But I'm just like, you know, how are you enjoying this, sweetie? Oh, my word. And that's what's happening in my heart. My head's going, but what about the servants? But what about the women? What about all the invisible people that surround this story of the invisible feeling middle sister? What about that? So, you know. So, it'd be so unlike me to take the direct way, wouldn't it? The song that I'm talking about is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. You might have heard it. This week, you might have even heard it at the mall. O come, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lowly exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. So Emmanuel, as many of you will know, is a name that means God with us. And in the Christian tradition, that points to Jesus, God in human form, or some variation of that idea. In the song, the Israel in the song becomes kind of like a stunt double for all of our longings to experience freedom, a fresh start, all these kind of things. But always in this context of having to believe a certain story about how God as a personal being breaks into the story and rescues the depraved, or at least the hapless, humans. So that's always the frame. Now, there are many things about that particular mythology that I think are truly lovely and powerful, not the least of which is this idea that God can be both with us and within us, both ordinary in the sense of babies are born every day, and miraculous in the sense of babies are born every day. Like, have you ever been there for that? You know, some of you have not only been there for that, you have done that. How remarkable, how utterly staggering, how I am silent in the face of. Mysterious is that. How many times a day does that happen? How ordinary is that? Twice a second? You could only call that ordinary. Or miraculous, or you see what I mean? It's that intersection, right? But to set that kind of longing into a religious framework that is both nationalistic and religiously exclusive, well, for me at least, that's a pretty big problem. Now you might be thinking, Tim, you're kind of making a big deal out of a not a big deal. Why can't you just enjoy the song already? This might be only my problem, but I don't seem to be capable of that. Here's the punchline. Did you know that the most common melody we use for O come, O come, Emmanuel, O come, Emmanuel, that one? Did you know that that is a 15th century funeral dirge? That's where that melody comes from. That melody has been sung over countless departed people. That melody has been about the ache of loss for a long, long time. And now we sing it as an Advent song, as a song about anticipated arrival, about anticipated birth. So it turns out that O Come, O Come, Emmanuel is a both and song. A song of birth and a song of death, and a beautiful, enduring engagement with both. There are all kinds of things about this life, and I would say maybe even about this particular season or time of year, that can feel like they live in that sort of profound tension. Now think about it for a minute. We've got all this stuff on our calendar right now. It's like woohoo stuff, right? It's parties, it's big events, it's concerts, it's recitals if you're in our house. It's because all these, it's all the seasonal celebrations. Don't answer this out loud. Do they ever start to feel like endless obligations to you? What is it this weekend, right? You know, where do we have to be? We got family get-togethers on the calendar. Anybody else feel like, you know, man, I'm not going to make it through dinner without another drink? You're like, we're coping with this thing that's just writ large as, this is going to be awesome! Crisis of nations is moving from a simmer to a boil, and it's doing it at the exact same time that the power holders are wishing their denizens a joyous holiday season. And then there's the earth. Is it more environmentally sensitive to buy a plastic tree or to harvest a living one? I'll tell you what, since that's a German tradition that actually got introduced to the Western world during Regency England's period of history, maybe we should just put up a picture of a tree. Oh, but then there's the ink and the... You see what I'm saying? It's all this tension. And we have not yet talked about the wave of debt that follows our orgy of consumption, or how if you live in Winnipeg, this all happens at a time of year when there's minimum daylight and maximum cold, and we find that difficult as a species. Tim, you're a bummer. You should shut up and sit down. I'm going to do that right away, but this first. Maybe all of this points to the complex reality, to the confounding, mysterious beauty of what we just use a word like being human for. Maybe what it points to is this always present intersection of things like birth and death, both of which can call out of us the shattering depths of love. I don't think the fact that we sing a song of anticipation inside of the Christian tradition that is based on a funeral dirge is kind of accidental. I think it's more like mysterious. I think it's a thing to be silent in the face of and attend to. I think it points us somewhere beyond us. That's why it's got power. And I don't just mean that particular song. I'm illustrating from that particular song, but it could be all kinds of different things. Love, says the writer of the Hebrew Song of Songs, is as strong as death. It sparks our fiery flames, the fiercest blaze of all. Mighty waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. In the ancient world, there were only a couple of things that you could imagine that might be equal in power to something like a fire that sweeps away everything in front of it. River sweeps away everything in front of it. The writer's reaching for the biggest tools in their toolbox to try to illustrate the power of love and to hold that power together in this context that is both death and birth. A thoughtful artist I know put it this way, writing about our experience now in the 21st century, I see these days as the advent of the advent. We are yet being formed from this earth where infinity collides to give birth. Our memory of how we are made is refocusing after a long, blind, fluorescent groping through the two bright halls of certitude. I wish I could have written that sentence. That's a good one. Our memory of how we are made is refocusing after a long, blind, fluorescent groping through the two bright halls of certitude. Maybe the best thing we can do with these kind of tensions, these mysteries that stir our hearts, is to be silent and open before them. Maybe the best way to guard our hearts is to be attentive to the presence of love in these places where we don't expect to find it. in the places that are dissonant, that are conflicted, that are difficult, that are sad. Maybe all of this long season of longing happens within a love that so envelops us from moment to moment that if it weren't for the things that get the attention of our hearts, birth, death, challenges, if it weren't for the things that get the attention of our hearts, we could miss it entirely. Peace.